the communities that we've been working for all our lives. I want to...
All right. We just got 15 seconds. 15 seconds.
Viva Al Rojas, who was one of Fatima's mentors in Sacramento.
Thank you, both.
Can we laugh?
We appreciate your presence. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. In short, the period was very much like the present period.
You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
Hello. Hello. 1, 2, 3. Hello. I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
Yeah.
And again, you're tuned to Hard Knock here on the Pacifica Network. I'm your host, Anita Johnson. And for the listening family of Hard Knock Radio, we have a very special treat. We're going to travel back down memory lane with the R&B group High Five. Now, this group took the R&B music industry by storm in the 90s with songs like She's Playing Hard to Get or I Like the Way, the song that we started it off at the beginning of the show. So with that said, I am very pleased to introduce to the listening family of Hard Knock Radio, Tristan and Bobby. Thank you both for joining us today here on Hard Knock Radio. And just jumping straight into this conversation for the listeners who may not be that familiar with High Five, take us back to the beginning. How did the group first come about or come to be? Was it an organic process, meaning like you guys formed on your own, like Voltron, or was it more like a manufactured NSYNC kind of model that brought the group together?
I would say that it was kind of like a combination of both, per se. Rest in peace to my man Tony Thompson, who passed away. He was singing in church and things of that nature. That's what he was known for when he was a very when he was really young. And we had relatives that was involved in the music industry. That kind of like put us on, we'll put Tony on with Jive Records. Tony cut a couple of demos. William Walton, shout out to William Walton. He the one who really put High Five together. And they wind up finding Marcus, Pooh, Roger Pooh Clark, Toriano Easley, and Russell Neal. And they put them together with Tony. Jive had wanted, you know, a five-man group, and then that's how that happened.
Okay. Considering where we're at right now when we think about the music industry, one thing that I've noticed is that there are a lack of boy bands. Boy bands pretty much are non-existent. You came up during a time where it was something that we saw. I grew up in the New Edition era. You know, you have Silk, you have All For One, you have NSYNC, you have all these various groups that exist, these boy bands, that was a thing once upon a time. We're talking about the 80s and the 90s. And then we can go back even further when we look at the Temptations. What do you think happened within the industry where that became, where things ended in that space, where that thing no longer existed when we think about boy bands?
Streaming.
Explain.
Streaming happened. Extreming, piracy, all that good stuff. So when the money structure changed within the record companies and there was no longer the traditional record sale, like you go to Target, Walmart, Moving Records, you know, FYI, places like that to actually physically purchase an album. So once that changed and it becomes, oh, I can just buy a single and not buy this whole album, the money changed within the record industry. So when that money was less, you know, they started realizing how expensive it was to do groups, to do boy bands and do groups. Because now versus a solo artist where you got to get one hotel, one plane ticket, you got to have one mic, you don't need a whole bunch of soundstage stuff and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's the way they went because, you know, five plane tickets, five hotel rooms, you know, limos that can accommodate, you know, the guys and their security and their management team and all of that stuff, it becomes very, very expensive. So basically what the industry did was, you know, consolidate their artist repertoire, you know, into, you know, solo artists and even smaller groups so they could save money because they were no longer making the money that they used to make because of record sales.
Knowing that and looking at where we're at right now, especially around streaming, the way in which the music industry has transitioned and a lot of things have changed and shifted, what do you all see as the pros and cons to where we're at currently when we think about the state of music and the way in which the business has been operating thus far in regards to the relationship to artists?
Pros and cons. A pro is that it's, you know, with social media and all of that, it's a little bit easier to be seen. But just because you're seen doesn't mean you have hot music. You know, there was a there was a time where music was curated. You had an artist development thing where only the best artists were out. You only heard, you know, the top of the top, which kept, you know, the music game at a certain level. Now anybody can cut a record and put it out tomorrow. You know what I mean? And it may not necessarily be good, but it can flood your algorithm. And now that's what you're hearing. So that's a con. You know, the pros, yeah, you can be seen, but the con is that there's no artist development. So anybody can put stuff out. And, you know, it takes a lot of money to push the record the way that it should be pushed. And for independent artists, that's like, it's something that is very rare that they have the amount of money or support team it takes to actually push a record and, you know, get it going on the charts and on the radio.
Mm-hmm. You know, I once heard a conversation that Rafael Sadiq of 2020 was having with an interviewer about the way in which this industry is structured. When we think about old school artists and new school artists, and we're just talking about a matter of decades, right? He was saying that really where artists, and it's important, even if they don't generate, say, top 10 albums, right? Or top 10 hits, mm-hmm. they'll make the bulk of their money on touring as long as they have a solid catalog. Now, when we think about High Five's catalog, it's beyond solid, right? When you think about producers like Teddy Riley and just the hits that you all were able to have, talk a bit about how that consistency in regards to the catalog has allowed you all to be able to tour and generate revenue throughout the years. Because in many cases, a lot of artists disappear and they don't have the opportunity based on their catalog and the lack of hits or the lack of memories that they generated for the listeners throughout the years and being consistent.
Well, you know, one of the things is that we're thankful that we're able to do that, that we have enough hits to have a solid catalog. That's number one. And, you know, even though we do have a solid catalog, you know, you got to find the promoters got to put us out there so that we could be out there and live and work. Even though we have a solid catalog, if they don't know that we're working or they're not looking for us so that we can work, then, you know, it's just another catalog, you know what I mean? But if they put us in front of our fans so that we can work, because, you know, there are some fans that are still out there that, you know, that grew up with us,
right?
That are still there, that went to a tour when we was younger, when it was High Five, Tony, and God, some stuff like that. So, right. I mean, I think, like, you know, if a show like that were to come back, you know, High Five, Tony, and Guy. You know, something. I'm just saying. You know, those same fans that was at that concert that are still here that grew up. What's making them not come back to go to the show as we got a little bit older? You know what I mean? So right. It's definitely, for me, it's definitely, you know, the promoters got to know and got to put us in front, or, you know, in front of the fans and let the fans know that we out there working so that we could perform our songs for the fans, if right. that makes sense.
No, it makes sense. For me, it's very nostalgic to be able to be an adult at this point in time and then to reminisce on the first time that you, say, saw a High Five, or the first time that you saw Boyz II Men, right? There's something about that, the connection that doesn't go away, because it places you. It places you at a particular space and time where, you know, if I'm being perfectly honest, you know, I wasn't adulting then. You know, there were certain things I just didn't have right. to worry about.
Exactly. Exactly. You know? Like, and that's exactly what it was meant to do. You know what I mean? It was meant to change your mood. It was meant to be thought-provoking and take you somewhere where it could relieve you from whatever stress is or whatever. You know, now as an adult, it's like, man, even some of the fans that never got a chance to go see High Five because either they didn't have the money or they weren't in an area where High Five was performing at the time, but now they have the money and, you know, people come out. Like, we've had a lot of sold out shows, and, you know, we did a city winery tour, we do an hour and a half show with a band, and it's like we go through a lot of the catalog, all of the hits, and then some of the favorites that weren't necessarily, you know, singles, we do those as well. So High Five has a really, really strong catalog. You know, we're able to do an hour and a half show. A lot of groups aren't able to do that. They have enough songs that, you know, were top 10s or even top 20s. Yeah, but, you know, just it, you're right, that nostalgic part, man, just to be able to come to a concert and kind of relive a place in your life that was good for you. Yes. Like, we love that. We love to see that on the fans' faces and hear it in, you know, their comments and all of that. That's something that keeps us going.
Absolutely.
Right. And then it's like when the fans say that, it's like Billy said, it's like for us, it's like, it's just reassuring, man. You know what I'm saying? It's a reassurance. It feels so good to let us know that we're on the right path and they're still digging it, you know?
Absolutely. Talk a bit about, because I have like a few more questions, but talk a bit about just in the sense of purpose as it relates to, when you say reassurance, to me, is I'm also hearing in my head purpose. Like, you all were created, you know what I'm saying, to do this. Because when you think about the joy that this music has brought a lot of people in, the way in which it's resonated with folks. I mean, people fell in love. You know, they might remember their first girlfriend because, you know what I'm saying? They were acting like they was Tony or Tristan singing, you know, like that was, that, there's a lot of that energy around there. But do you also feel in this point, the fact that you've been able to do it so long, because this is maybe the third iteration of High Five. There's still original members, but there's some new members in the group as well. And you guys, Tristan, you decided to bring everybody back together. Talk a bit about the purpose of High Five at this point in life.
Well, the reason being, it all stems from before Tony had passed away. Me being in his house, you know, we was going to put the group back together, and it was just a personal promise that I had gave Tony when the last time I seen him, that we was going to do it. So it you know, that was my inspiration to make it happen. So I believe that the purpose is, you know, is to continue on the legacy of the group, to continue on my legacy, and to start other people's legacy, and to be able to reach people with our music and just bring joy and happiness and awareness to, you know, other things that we all as individuals may have, you know, that may want us to, as individuals, to come out, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
What's the legacy of the group? You said to remember the legacy. What's the legacy of the group? How do you see it?
I see the legacy of the group as persistent, not giving up, going through certain things and still keeping on, and reaching to that point where it's like, you know, The book is still written, you know. The legacy is still being written, so I can't really say that right now. But I would want the legacy to be about a group that has some trials and tribulations and still wouldn't stop, and they still keep on keeping on until the good Lord says the job well done.
Absolutely. For the listening audience, I'm speaking
for sure
with members of High Five. They're performing July 24th at,
yes, we are,
at 8 p.m. at Yoshi's in Oakland, California. Now, this is not the 90s. We're in the 2025. What can the listeners expect to see? I mean, High Five, aside from the music, you guys were known for the dance moves.
Yep, you know, got them.
Billy, tell them we still got the dance moves, man.
still got them. We still got cats taking their shirts off, so we ain't no slouch.
Okay.
You know, come through, man. Experience it, man. We are still doing our thing. Like, you ain't gonna be bored. You're gonna have a fantastic time. You know, it's a lot of love, it's a lot of laughs, and we definitely take our audience to a place that, you know, they remember. Mm-hmm. It's all feel good music, man. It ain't, mm-hmm, you know, it's all feel good music. It's gonna evoke some kind of emotion in you, whatever that is.
Yep, and we're gonna be up there longer than 60 minutes.
It ain't
gonna
be 15 minutes.
Nah, it's gonna be 15 minutes. So come through. They're gonna be a 15 minute show. It's gonna be a show. Yeah, now come through. Man. Get a bottle, get a little sip of your favorite beverage and eat and get prepared to be entertained and have a High Five experience. We are excited. We haven't been to Oakland in like, I don't even know how long. It's time. We're ready. Yeah. We want to see everybody to come through, come hang out with us. Man, we excited. Let's go, man. Oakland, man. Come on. Come hang out with us.
And we're also
Bay Area. Let's go.
Outside of the Bay Area, we're syndicated in many places throughout the United States. And you guys are on a currently on a tour, right?
Not right now. We're working on a tour. But right now, we're not.
I thought Teddy Riley was bringing you guys out from time to time.
Oh, yeah. Well, when
oh, yeah,
we just did something with Teddy, yeah, not too long ago in Baltimore. So, I mean, you know, yeah, the new Jack. As soon as he call us, we here. You know, he knows that.
Yeah.
Okay, well,
that's how it goes. Still got great relationships, and we you know, whatever he got, we going.
Okay, I'm gonna mess with y'all real quick. You said that you guys got it. You still dance moves. Music is gonna be great, but tell me you guys are not taking those long music interludes in order to catch your breath. Y'all not doing none of that. Y'all look at Billy's face. Look at Billy's face.
I don't know. You may have to tell. I don't know. So I ain't gonna front. Your boy get tired sometimes. Your boy get tired, yo. Billy, you know I get tired, yo.
Yeah.
Long as you're not moving like Bobby Brown, you know what I'm saying, next to Rob Trezor, hey, I'm good.
Hey. Hey, Billy, yo, you about to tell him, Billy.
Bruh, like, we go hard, though. We ain't got no long music interludes. You know, we stop and talk, wipe our face a little bit, grab a little bit of water, and get right back at it. Like, yeah, ain't no intermissions.
No intermissions. We keep it going.
All right.
We'll be ready to go.
This is good to hear, and I'm definitely looking forward to seeing you all July 24th at Yoshi's in the city of Oakland, California. It's been really a pleasure speaking with you.
Make sure we take pictures, man. Make sure we take pictures and all that, yo.
Oh, wait. So you guys are taking pictures afterwards?
Yeah, we're doing all the things.
Okay, so basically there's a meet and greet at some point after the show. You guys are walking out into the waiting room or the maybe main eating area, seating area at Yoshi. So you guys will be meeting.
We might just walk out into the crowd.
Yoshi's is nice and intimate, man. We chilling.
Okay. Right. Okay. Right. All right, well, if it's nice and intimate, let me ask you this. I'm getting a little bit in your business. Being that you're going to be interacting with the fans, is everyone in the group married? Is it, you know, or single?
Everyone in the group is not married.
Okay. Look how he's so professional. Look how he did that. That's smooth.
That's only but the right answer.
Look, hey, well, I'm gonna give it to you. I'm gonna say something else, but I said we're gonna keep it PG for the listening audience of KPFA.
With
that said, I want to thank both of you for joining us today here on Hard Knock. It's been a pleasure.
Man, thanks.
Cool, thank
man.
You for
we
having us.
Appreciate y'all. Yeah, we appreciate everything. And for real, come through. Hey, everybody, come through. Come
Yoshi.
Through. Come see us. Yoshi's, y'all. We ready.
July 24th, Thursday night. Let's go. We about to have a party.
And if anybody wants to get in contact with High Five or just follow up and see what you guys are doing, is there a website or a way that they can connect with you guys?
Yeah, you could just go to our Instagram at Official High Five. Everything is there. Official High Five on our Instagram. And all you right. can connect with, you know, everywhere else.
All right. Thank you so much. All right. Take care.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. No problem. Appreciate it.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
and Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
And again, you're tuned to Hard Knock Radio here on the Pacifica Network. Up next on the program, we take a look at one of the most prolific Mexican artists, Frida Kahlo, through the lens of our friends at En Confianza with Pulso Podcast. Frida Kahlo's painted self-portraits have gained widespread recognition around the world. Younger generations continue to proudly lift up Frida as a symbol of unapologetic feminism and artistic freedom. And while Frida Kahlo's art has been widely popularized and even commercialized, it still represents bold self-determination and strength in the face of crushing patriarchy. Up next, we hear from producer Anthony Wallace about the story of Tanya Betancourt Alcazar, a member of the art group The Phoenix Fridas, who discovered a lifeline in the art of Frida Kahlo. By embracing Frida's artistic message of resilience and empowerment, Tanya would later find the inner strength to confront her own traumas and transform her pain into art.
Tanya Betancourt Alcazar made a big choice in her mid-20s.
I decided to be child-free by choice because I think that's my authenticity, like me saying, hey, I love children, but they're not for me.
In her world, this was a radical decision, and she was afraid to tell anyone about it.
All the women in my family have had children, so I'm kind of making my own path.
And in 2019, she was on a trip to LA with a new group of friends. They were in their hotel room crafting and painting together the night before ConchaCon, an art festival dedicated to the brightly colored Mexican pastries. And there she decided it was time to get the child-free thing off her chest.
And they were the first women that I shared with that I wanted to be child-free when I hadn't even shared that with my family. And I'm sorry, I'm getting choked up, but just to hear them like listen to my decision and then for them to like be mothers and following a different path than I was, but still saying, hey, I support you and I back you and they're not trying to change my mind. That meant the world to me.
That moment of deep empathy, of rebellion against cultural norms, it reflects the person that brought them all together. Her friends at the hotel that night were her fellow Phoenix Fridas, a Latina art collective dedicated to and named after the great Mexican artist Frida Kahlo. Most people, if they know Frida Kahlo at all, only know her face. But Tanya and her fellow Phoenix Fridas have considered her life and art much more deeply, and it's had a profound effect on them. Tanya was born in Mexico, moved to the U.S. as a small child, and when she started school, she didn't know English. She was timid, shy, and afraid to rock the boat.
That's something maybe I wanted to be more like, is like express myself more. As a kid, I felt like I couldn't express myself the way I wanted to. And I love that Frida Kahlo would do that. She would express herself and she didn't really care what people thought of her.
Frida Kahlo was courageous, defiant, bluntly honest, a fierce defender of the underdog and a powerful political activist. Behind Frida's famous unibrow is an inspiring, historic, and provocative story with the power to change lives.
Frida's work inspired me to be unapologetic, to be honestly a disruptor. Frida did whatever she wanted to, not as long as it made her happy, but as long as she was true to herself.
As a teenager, Frida Kahlo was physically impaled by a steel beam and broke her spine in a bus accident, and her body never really healed. She was in constant pain and constant need of surgery. She needed more than 30 over the course of her life. But she never stopped living, dancing, painting, and pushing boundaries, sometimes in bed with a cane or in a full torso cast. She wore a men's suit in a formal family photo in the 1920s, and she was shamelessly bisexual before that term was really a thing. She studied biology, philosophy, and history at the top prep school in Mexico, where she was one of only a few dozen girls in a student body of 2,000. She found her own way into the upper echelons of the Mexican Communist Party, where she got to know her husband, the legendary painter Diego Rivera. Together, they housed the Marxist revolutionary Leon Trotsky, as Stalinist agents threatened to scale their walls to murder him. Diego's lucrative murals led them to the United States, where they dined and drank with the Rockefellers and Fords, and used their power to subvert them. Diego painted Karl Marx at Rockefeller Center, and Frida mocked the Nazi-sympathizing Henry Ford to his face at a crowded dinner table. Two of the people Frida loved the most, Diego and her younger sister Christina, had an extended affair. She was broken physically, betrayed cruelly, and belittled by the press and the art world, not taken seriously as a painter in her own right. But she took all of her persistence, intellect, eye for beauty, and bloody pain, and infused it into her art. Her paintings are attention-grabbing, sometimes shocking, but always deeply thought-provoking. Tania found Frida when she was a shy kid who felt she didn't belong. Now she's a multimedia artist and communications coordinator for a nonprofit that is working to give power to marginalized communities. She's colorfully, passionately, and courageously fighting for what she believes in, just like Frida did. For Tania and many others like her, Frida Kahlo is a source of not only inspiration, but power. From Frida Kahlo and the Phoenix Fridas, Tania found the courage to be authentic. But what she didn't know, crafting in that hotel room in LA with her newest and closest confidants, is that tragedy would soon strike the Fridas, and she would need all of the resilience and courage she could muster to get through it. Today, Frida is everywhere. On thousands and thousands of products, t-shirts, tote bags, there's even a Frida Kahlo emoji set and a strangely light-skinned Frida Kahlo Barbie doll.
Frida Kahlo. Her work and her story inspires me every day.
But despite the fact that Frida's been dead for nearly 70 years, her mega fame is a relatively recent phenomenon.
I first encountered her in an art history classroom in the 1980s. And that time, she was not well known at all in the United States. And I thought, this is one powerful, powerful woman.
This is Celia Starr, an art historian at the University of San Francisco and the author of Frida in America, The Creative Awakening of a Great Artist. Frida died in the 1950s, and for a while after her death, she was pretty obscure. Then, in the early 80s, a major biography about her hit the shelves and she started to pop up in mainstream culture. During her life, Frida sold paintings for less than $200. In the 70s, you could buy one for $40,000. By 1990, they were going for well over $1 million.
I'm starting to see in the 90s, it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And I really thought we had reached a point of saturation.
The Frida face t-shirts multiplied. People talked about Frida mania. But when it seemed like she couldn't get any bigger, she did.
Behind the madness lies the mystery of one of the most seductive and most intriguing women of ours or any time.
To Frida! To
Frida! Frida.
And then, of course, we have the movie Frida come out based on the biography. And then Salma Hayek really brings her to another level of fame in the United States.
The movie made over $50 million at the box office and sent Frida mania into full swing. When it came out, Tania was 10 years old.
I didn't know much about Frida until the movie. My mom and I watched it, and it was like the first time we saw representation of our country, our culture, right? Like on the big screen.
At the time, Tania and her mom hadn't been in the U.S. for very long.
I was born in Mexico, in Chihuahua, Mexico, and then my mom first came out to the United States, and then I followed. So, I was 3 years old, so I'm very proud Mexican-American.
At first, they lived in San Francisco, where Tania's mom met who had become her stepdad. He was an immigrant himself from Guatemala. Together, they made a lively household.
Like my dad's side was more like merengue and cumbia. My mom's side was a little bit more rancheras and Selena. So it was two different worlds, but I am so glad that I grew up in that.
But of course, the transition to a new country was difficult, especially when Tania started school.
I grew up knowing Spanish at home, speaking Spanish at home, and then having to switch to English in school was tough at first because I didn't know the language. I was definitely very shy as a kid. I moved schools often, so I was always the new kid. I dealt with bullying, you know, so I always relate with outcasts. I relate with them because I feel like I was an outcast. I found solace in like Harry Potter because he was an outcast as well. Very different, strange child.
Frida was also a strange child, often forced into isolation. When she was six, she got polio, which left her with one skinny leg and a lifelong limp. And when she was 18, the wooden bus she was riding home was shattered in a violent collision with a trolley car. Her spinal column, ribs, collarbone, pelvis, and right leg were broken. A steel handrail impaled her, piercing her abdomen, damaging her uterus, and exiting out her groin. Doctors expected her to die, but as she would do throughout her life, she defied expectations. From that point on, she spent weeks and months at a time alone, debilitated and confined to bed. She developed a deep affinity for the forgotten people, the poor, the Harry Potters, and the outcasts of the world. Here's Frida expert Celia Starr again.
Frida was somebody who was always for the underdog. You know, she was dealing with physical disabilities, and as a bisexual woman, she often was marginalized.
But the accident didn't just make Frida more empathetic. It ultimately energized her and made her the Frida Kahlo we know today. She got a special easel that was connected to her bed, and she started painting. Frida painted a self-portrait called The Broken Column. In it, her torso is split in half vertically, and a crumbling Roman column is in the place of her spine. Nails puncture her skin all over her body, and tears fall from her eyes, but her expression is stoic. Growing up, Tanya also found solace in honest artistic expression.
I would just like draw and doodle. And then also I like to document my life too, like diaries, which is also a form of being creative. I feel like I've been a multi-passionate creative all my life, sewing, photography, video. That's a little bit about me.
Tanya's family moved to Phoenix. Her parents had two more kids, her little sisters, and she grew up. She started a YouTube channel with her husband and did some work as a photographer. She kept coming out of her shell and pushing the limits of her self-expression. But still, in her mid-20s, she felt like she was missing the close group of friends she never made in school.
I have a very traumatic history of having female friends in my life. You know, I went through bullying and things like that. So I think 2017 was the year that I really wanted to be surrounded by creative women, have like female friends more in my life.
And that's where Mo came in.
My husband's friend, who became my friend, Mo, her name Monique, she was working at Tres Leches Cafe. She hit up Jose and she was like, hey, I saw your channel and I wish you could like do a feature on our cafe.
We're checking out this Mexican gourmet cafe, which is located in Central Phoenix.
Yeah, so we're really excited. You guys are gonna love this place. It's awesome.
Yeah.
They went to visit and vlog at Tres Leches, and Tanya met Mo, who was a Phoenix Frida. At that point, the Fridas had been around for over a decade. They were a tight-knit group and highly respected in the Phoenix art scene. They didn't let new people in all the time, but Mo saw something in Tanya.
From that point on, we just started talking. Like, she saw my videos. Mo said that I should join the Phoenix Fridas, so they brought me on, and I had friends for life. Like, I was honestly so happy just to be a part of a creative group and that they recognized and saw that I was a creative woman in the community too. So I felt really honored by that.
The group put on joint art shows, threw an annual birthday party for Frida, did a pilgrimage to Frida's house in Mexico City, and talked a lot about Frida's work together. The conversations brought them all closer to each other and closer to Frida. And they made Tanya bolder and more confident.
I created one of her self-portraits where she chopped off all her hair. And my rebellion was that I dyed my hair blue because my mom would always be like, oh, those are like crazy colors, you know? So for me, that was my rebellion.
One of the best new friends she made in the group was Luisa Leon, who was just a few years older than her.
You know, Luisa, she had very colorful hair. Like, I related with her in that. And she was very colorful, just like her paintings.
Luisa was there when Tanya told the group about her plans to be child-free.
She would tell me, she's like, I feel like you're a mom already. You are a nurturer. So she saw things in me that I didn't see.
Luisa, Mo, and the rest of the Phoenix Fridas quickly became Tanya's friends, confidants, and motivators. As they pushed her to become herself and be fearless creatively, she developed a pretty radical approach to social media, especially with her autobiographical Second a Day videos.
I started to not only turn the camera toward me, but also turn the camera toward myself when I wasn't at my highest point of feeling the best I could be. And that is very similar to Frida. She documented a lot of her pain, her suffering. A lot of my 1 seconds do have that. Like, they show when I'm crying or show when I've been distressed. Social media in a way is a form of art, right? Expression of like what is going on in your life. So I think when I started being really raw and honest and documenting my life, at least on social media, I would get people in the DMs and be like, I completely feel the way you do.
In her 1 second videos, she cries, dances, goes to concerts and does Zoom meetings. She sews, lays in bed, makes coffee, and hangs with her family. Recently, she's been kicking pads and playing games in karate class, alongside a bunch of elementary school kids. In one post, she opens up about being child-free by choice, and another about her insecurity about being a light-skinned Latina. Her honesty is attention-grabbing. The posts start conversations about taboo things people would normally keep inside.
How did it like feel to be having these conversations?
I definitely felt I wasn't alone anymore. I didn't feel as isolated as I felt, especially like in the height of the pandemic, going through, you know, depression, going through just so many things, losing people in my life. I think I didn't feel as alone.
When the pandemic shut things down in 2020, the Phoenix Fridas did what they could to continue bringing color and life into the world, even remotely. Tanya did a special quarantine photo series, and her friend Luisa did Instagram live painting lessons for 100 consecutive nights. And it even got some news coverage.
She started painting lives with Luisa mid-March and has quickly gained momentum.
It started with having about 5 people watching me, until now, which is over 100 people every night tuning in. This experience for me has just reinstated what I always wanted to know, which was my purpose in life. And I think my purpose is to get other people to just create for themselves and just have fun doing it.
But on top of the same isolation and fear of the virus that we all felt, Tanya was forced to stare at all of 2020's horrible news all day long. She was a layout designer for a major newspaper company, and it was taking a toll on her mental health. And making things worse, her employer restricted her from responding to the news with her usual passion and honesty.
When George Floyd happened, the, you know, Black Lives Matter demonstrations happened, you couldn't go and like hold a sign or nothing like that. That would be like under violation. So I was like fed up. I felt, you know, like I couldn't express myself the way I wanted to.
So she turned to her fellow Fridas, Luisa specifically.
I was like telling her that I hate my job. She's like, let's get you a better job. She really pushed me.
With Luisa motivating her, Tanya got serious about finding a new job. But about a year into the pandemic, tragedy hit the Fridas. Mo was just 42 years old, but Tanya said she had psoriasis and it took a bad turn during quarantine.
It was February 2021. Mo had been struggling with her health and her organs weren't working on by themselves anymore. So she unfortunately passed away She was very young, you know, still. You know, I went to her funeral, and some of the Fridas went, some of us, you know, we're still very in the deep of the pandemic, so it was hard, right?
Just a couple months later, Luisa, who was just 33, came down with COVID.
In July, we got the news that she had gotten COVID, and then, you know, we prayed for her. We thought she was going to be out of it, you know, just given her age. Then following month, she was gone.
Luisa Leon died in August of COVID-19, and she inspired many people during this pandemic as she taught hundreds of people how to paint online. And she did this for 100 days straight during quarantine, reaching people all over the world.
It's just very, very sudden. And it was very hard for all of us. You know, I still remember us being like in a room and just crying. It's just, she really motivated me. She was very unapologetic. Something I always admired about her. She always would see the bright side in things. She just found a way to like bring light into darkness. And I really miss her. She meant a lot to me.
With Luisa's encouragement and help, Tanya did get that new job.
She was always like motivating me, and I never got to tell her that I got a new job. I never got to tell her. And I know she's with me. Like, I'm even looking at that sticker on my water bottle, and she had blue hair, you know, and I know she shows up for me. Whenever I want to feel bold or unapologetic, I always try to channel her. I really miss her. I really miss both her and Mo.
2021 for Tanya was a seemingly relentless barrage of emotional pain.
I think two things got me through difficult times. One was family and friends. And then two, I think I really found solace in my sewing machine. I would sew a lot. I would make things for friends, and I would just sit there and listen to podcasts or listen to music, and I would just make things, you know.
And always by her sewing machine is a little picture of Frida Kahlo.
Yeah, that postcard I got in Ciudad de Mexico. And I always have her there as like inspiration.
And she found purpose in the new job that Luisa inspired her to get.
I am a marketing and communications coordinator. I work for an organization called Instituto. It's based here in Arizona. It's an organization that helps build political infrastructure with low income and communities of color here in the state.
During these last midterm elections, she even knocked on doors and helped get a bill passed that allows DACA recipients who live in Arizona to get in-state tuition rates for college. And this political work, Tanya also sees as following in Frida's footsteps.
She was fighting for the working class. And then also like her sexuality too, like she was very outspoken about that as well.
Yes, she was, you know, she was a very political person. She was interested in communism early on before she meets Diego Rivera. Oftentimes, you know, people say, oh, it's because of Diego that she got interested in communism. Not true. I mean, she called herself a child of the revolution.
Frida sometimes shifted her birth year from 1907 to 1910, the year of the peasant-led Mexican Revolution. Together, Diego and Frida helped create a new Mexican culture and national identity, magnifying the poor, indigenous, and working people of Mexico.
By the time she gets to the United States, and it's 1933, she's seen a lot. You know, she has seen the people who can't afford to eat lined up on streets and waiting, you know, to just get some soup. But then at the same time, she's hobnobbing with, you know, the Rockefellers. And there you have, you know, the exact opposite.
She wanted authenticity, raw beauty, to stick up for the outcast and to expose hypocrisy. Frida loved MoMA and the jazz clubs in Harlem. Her paintings showed black protesters in New York and dystopian smokestack landscapes in Detroit. At one dinner party hosted by the mogul Henry Ford, an anti-Semite who Hitler praised in Mein Kampf, Frida played dumb. At a lull in the conversation, she asked, "Mr. Ford, are you Jewish?" There was an awkward silence and then an uproar of laughter.
She was incredibly bold for her time period, but she's still bold today. I mean, that's what's amazing, right? Is that the unibrow, for example, is still bold.
After they lost Mo and Louisa, the Phoenix Fridas retired the group after 18 years.
Having the passing of our members too felt like a chapter closing. Like, it kind of felt odd to continue without them. And I think the group had accomplished its purpose of bringing joy and love of Frida into Phoenix.
Frida Kahlo and the Phoenix Fridas made their mark and changed their world. Tanya was once timid and bullied. Now she's courageously and creatively asserting herself, saying what others are afraid to. And while she was once new to the U.S., unable to speak English, she's now a political force, making her mark on the country. And as she's evolved, she's become more like her hero she first saw on a Hollywood movie. And the ripples of Frida mania are still flowing out everywhere. Yes, there is something ironic about Frida as a brand, given her feelings about capitalism. But even when you only see that unibrow out of context, it leaves an impression. Every Frida bag, every Frida drink or pair of socks, is just another chance for someone to pause and wonder, who is that person really?
Frida is a gateway to Mexican culture. And she's not just a flower crown. She was political. Everything about her struggles was like intersectional, right? Her disability, her politics, her sexuality. You have to take all parts of her, not just cherry pick. And I think she creates conversation to this day. And that's what I really love about her, is that she's still stirring up drama, you know, she's still stirring up controversy. And I think that's her.
When she was 47, Frida's always tenuous health took a turn for the worse, and she came down with a bad case of pneumonia. Still in July of 1954, she summoned what little life she had left and took to the streets of Mexico City by wheelchair to protest the CIA's intervention in Guatemala. Less than 2 weeks later, her funeral procession went down the same city streets. As Frida's body was pushed into the crematorium, a strange thermodynamic phenomenon took place. The dead artist suddenly sprung into an upright position, her hair on fire and her mouth apparently smiling. Even her dead body defied limitations as it arose and glowed with an infectious energy. And her power and influence continues to grow, making new generations of determined, bold fighters for life and defiers of limitation. The year before she died, she had to have her leg amputated. In her diary, she wrote, "Feet, what do I need them for if I have wings to fly?"
And that's it for today's program. If you want more information about Hard Knock Radio, log on to kpfa.org. Click on Archive to hear past shows. Or you can also visit us on Instagram as well as Facebook. Again, I am Anita Johnson. Thank you so much for listening to Hard Knock Radio. We'll check you all out next week, y'all. Be safe and peace.
In the realm of the airwaves, where the truth does spin,
Hard Knock Radio takes the mic. Let the dialogue begin.
From the heart of the culture, where the beats do sway.
Thank you. Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Rev up your support for KBOO Community Radio. Have an old car taking up space? Donate it to KBOO. Your unused vehicle can become music to our ears, powering independent radio that amplifies